Leading Lines. I'm Derek Bruff. Happy New Year. We're starting our 2019 season with an interview with Anna Bostwick Fleming, Associate Director at the Center for Teaching in the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the University of Iowa. Anna heads up the faculty development programming for Iowa's Active Learning Classroom Initiative called TILE. Listeners may remember that we launched our 2018 season with another interview about active learning classrooms, also with someone from the University of Iowa. Check out episode 32 of Leading Lines for my conversation with Cornelia Lang, who teaches astronomy in TILE classrooms at Iowa. Cornelia is one of 500 instructors at Iowa who have participated in Center for Teaching workshops on teaching in active learning classrooms. 500 instructors. When I heard that figure at the Pod Network conference last fall, I sought out Anna to learn about the ways her center prepares and supports faculty to teach well in these innovative learning spaces. In the interview, Anna talks about the origin of the Active Learning Classroom Initiative at Iowa. She describes the kinds of programming her center offers to prepare faculty to teach well in these spaces, and she shares some very concrete strategies for teaching in active learning classrooms. Well, Anna, thanks for chatting with me here today at Pod. I'm glad we were able to find a quiet room for a little chat. Let's start by having you tell us a little bit about kind of who you are and your background and how you came to this role at the University of Iowa.
Absolutely. So my name is Anna Bostwick Fleming, and I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Teaching at the University of Iowa, which is part of the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Technology. So I've been part of the Center for Teaching for about 4 or 5 years now, and working with TILE for about the last 3 or 4 years. So my background is actually in history and women's studies, and it turns out that actually humanities are a really natural fit for active learning classrooms, even though we know that the history of active learning classrooms tells us that STEM was some of the first popularizers and users of active learning classrooms.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that for sure. So tell us about the TILE initiative at Iowa. How did it get started, and what does it look like now?
So about 8 years ago, a couple of things converged. We had a pretty massive flood on the University of Iowa campus. There was a need to revitalize some classroom spaces at the University of Iowa, and a number of pretty forward-thinking administrators brought together a group of people to think about what might it look like to design some new classrooms that would allow students to be actively engaged in learning. And one of the things that they did was bring together not only folks who were designing classroom spaces, but also folks who were thinking deeply about pedagogy, including Jean Foreman, who was the director and still is the director of the Center for Teaching.
Okay. And that, I mean, I find that kind of exciting. I think in some of the classroom redesign initiatives that I've either heard of or been tangentially involved in, I mean, we had one on our campus where I was involved, but well along into the process. And so luckily, I mean, we had a dean who was pretty savvy about pedagogy, and so the classroom ended up pretty great, actually. But to have teaching center folks, to have pedagogy folks involved so early in the process, I think is pretty exciting. How would you say that kind of shaped what happened?
Active learning classrooms, including the TILE initiative at the University of Iowa, are very much about collaborative learning. And I think that collaboration is not just about what students do in the classroom, it's embedded in the history of how TILE was formed. So the Center for Teaching was part of the conversations early on. The registrar was part of the conversations early on because they're responsible for classroom scheduling. Mm-hmm. So having all of the right people at the table from the very beginning is really crucial to making sure that you're thinking through a complex initiative like this without missing any of the final points, because everyone's bringing a different perspective to the table.
And now Iowa has several TILE classrooms. And what does TILE stand for?
TILE stands for Transform, Interact, Learn, Engage. And sometimes folks will think the T stands for technology. And I really love, and I can't take credit for this predates me, I love that the T doesn't stand for technology, because it's not just about the technology in spaces. And in fact, we've created some that have very limited technology. Mm-hmm. It's about how can those spaces help to support the kind of learning and teaching that you're hoping to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll talk. We can talk more about the technology piece, but this was something We interviewed D. Christopher Brooks on the podcast about a year ago, and he pointed me to some research that indicates that, in fact, it may be some of the lower-tech components of an active learning classroom that kind of do the most good in terms of student learning and student engagement. Can you describe, just so our listeners can kind of have a picture, what does a kind of high-tech classroom look like at Iowa, and what does a low-tech active learning classroom look like?
Absolutely. So the very first Todd classrooms that were built on the scale-up model, and that's the active learning classroom designed by Bob Buechner at North Carolina State. And so those are round tables, and Professor Buechner, who's a physicist, is a physicist, spent a lot of time thinking very deeply about every nuance of the designs that he was developing in his teaching. And so we have the round tables with the specific dimensions that he has figured out worked out really well for his students. So each round table seats 9 students. There are multiple tables in each classroom space, and we have classrooms that seat different amounts of students. Each round table has its own monitor, so a large LED screen. And then the classroom also has some large projector screens. And so individual tables can project their own work onto their own individual monitor. And then the instructor has the capacity to determine that maybe table 2 has come up with some really intriguing idea. And so they can then project that information out to all of the screens, or maybe to only half of the screen, so that students can compare and contrast what table 2 did compared to what table 4 did.
Okay.
And so students are engaged not just in developing their own ideas within their small groups, but also in comparing and evaluating between and among groups.
And so I've seen a couple of these classrooms. I got to visit Iowa a few years ago. I think another key feature is that there's really often no center of the room, right? There's no central focus point.
Exactly, yeah. So the instructor's station, I guess, is usually sort of in the center of the room. And so one of the first things that happens when students or when faculty enter the space is they notice there is no front of room. And some people will react by saying, well, this is a poorly designed room. How am I supposed to lecture in here? And some people will react and say, this is a wonderfully designed room. My students will be able to talk to each other in here.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the faculty development that we do around these spaces is about exploring what's possible in these spaces, what they're well designed for, and what maybe don't, won't work as well in these spaces. So we actually did a survey with faculty 2014 and 2015, and we asked them a lot about what are the various affordances in the classrooms that they most appreciated. And in addition to a lot of them really appreciating the technology and the way that allows students to share information with each other and with the instructor, a lot of them really focused in on the whiteboards and on the ability to be in seating patterns where they could actually see each other. You know, students are in chairs that are nailed down to the floor and in straight lines, they can maybe turn to a neighbor, but 3 in a row, it's really hard for them to have a real conversation.
Yeah. I was at dinner last night here at the conference, and we had, I think, 9 people around our table, right? So a similar size. And even then, like 4 people talking in a noisy room can be a little challenging.
Yeah,
and that, you know, and that's when we're actually, you know, actually kind of looking at each other.
Absolutely, yeah. And so all of the very highly technology-laden classroom spaces do have those features of pretty much wall-to-wall whiteboards and round tables. But we realized that there was a need for classroom spaces that maybe didn't need as much of the technology, didn't need laptops provided, didn't need monitors everywhere. They just needed flexible seating and a whole lot of whiteboards. And so we built 2 spaces that are just like that. Instead of round tables, they're movable, very flexible, individual student desks. The actual desk part can move up and down and left and right so that students can bring the desk part together in whatever configuration makes sense. And so instructors are able to put students in groups of 3 or in groups of 6 or in groups of 4 or whatever is most appropriate for the activity that they're doing. And they have all of the whiteboards so that students can be working simultaneously, seeing what each other is writing, maybe getting ideas from what another group is doing. The instructor can stand right in the middle of those classroom spaces and see, oh, wow, this group is coming up with an idea that I maybe did not expect anyone to come up with. and they can maybe draw attention to it or help coach in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they can see that one group is struggling, they're not writing anything, so maybe they're so deep in conversation they're forgetting to move forward.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're just totally stuck, and that's the first group that the instructor might go visit.
Sure.
Instead of being in a room of 81 students and not knowing how any of the students are potentially processing information, they have a really quick read on how almost everyone in the room is processing information.
Yeah.
Powerful.
And, you know, I was talking to my colleague Peter Newberry at University of British Columbia, and he, I was talking to him about whiteboards, and he pointed out that if students are working in small groups and not using a whiteboard, and an instructor wants to know how they're doing, if they're struggling, what questions they need, he or she has to go over and basically eavesdrop, right? And that can change the dynamic of that small group conversation when the instructor sits down with you. But with the whiteboards, you can see from a distance what they're up to and figure out which groups need that kind of intervention, which is subtle, but it seems really useful.
Absolutely. It makes learning visible, visible from far away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you mentioned the faculty development work that you do. So what does that look like at Iowa? What, how do you help prepare faculty to teach well in these very non-traditional teaching spaces?
Yeah, so from the beginning, the provost's office understood the importance of faculty development in these spaces. So we actually have a model where basically anyone who participates in faculty development gets priority access in these spaces, and demand for these spaces is so high that priority access means access.
Oh, okay.
University of Iowa. So the registrar actually keeps a list of everyone who's participated in our professional development, and we just had a big celebration because that number is at about 500 now.
500
yes,
faculty?
500 faculty.
Have gone through this
yes,
workshop
yes.
preparation.
One or other of the iterations that we've had over the last 8 or so years. And what's really exciting about that is that that includes graduate students, that includes instructional staff, it includes clinical track, it includes tenure track. We're involved with faculty who are teaching all kinds of courses in all kinds of disciplines from all kinds of professional tracks within the university.
Wow.
And so TILE has really been sort of an engine for cultural change around
yeah.
the way we think about teaching and learning, which is really exciting. So the registrar keeps this list of who's been part of that professional development, and that's how people get access to the classroom spaces. So that professional development has evolved over the years. In the early years, it was a multi-day institute. The very first one, Bob Beekner actually was part of it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We went straight to the top.
Right. Call him Big Gun. That's great.
Exactly. There was a core group of fellows from a bunch of different disciplines, and some of them came in as complete skeptics. One of my favorite examples is Alison Bianchi, who is a professor in sociology. She actually directs the Center for the Study of Group Processes at the University of Iowa. So this is her wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And one of the things she thinks a lot about is how do group dynamics affect people, especially people who might be underrepresented, who might find that group interactions lead them out of conversations rather than include them in conversations. And so she came in as a skeptic, someone who thinks very critically about places where group dynamics can maybe cause problems. Mm-hmm. And she left as a huge advocate for TILE. And we actually bring her back to talk to new TILE faculty pretty frequently. She's also consulted with other universities to talk about the specific strategies that instructors can use to ensure that if there's some kind of problematic group dynamic developing, that instructors know how to either arrange groups or intervene in groups to ensure that everybody is having equal access in order to be wrestling with whatever the material is at hand.
Could you say more about that? Because I do think that I think it's kind of my own bias sometimes that I've seen all the research on active learning. I've seen group work go so well in the classroom. And that even in a traditional lecture hall, if I'm doing a think, pair, share or a clicker activity where students are turning to their neighbor, for me it's very energizing to hear 100 statistics students all talking about statistics at the same time. But I think sometimes I can miss the fact that maybe some of those pairs and trios are actually not functioning very well. What advice would you give to a faculty member who's wanting to kind of make sure that small group activity is actually as inclusive as we would like it to be?
Yeah. There are a couple of techniques that I think can be really powerful, and these are things that we talk about in our professional development and that people like Allison use all the time, a lot of research by Elizabeth Cohen and others, who actually look mostly in the K-12 world because it's a space where these things can really be important issues as well. And so things like starting the class by talking to students about their previous experiences with group work.
Okay.
So some students have had great experiences. Some students have had the kinds of experiences, you know, you're smiling. You know,
yeah.
That happens a lot when we discuss this. You know, some students have had the experience where they feel like they end up doing all the work for everybody else.
Yeah, and frankly, I think a lot of academics felt that way, right?
Absolutely.
Like those of us who pursue higher education and now teaching it, often our undergraduate experiences with group work weren't great.
Exactly. And there could be a couple of dynamics happening in those kinds of cases. It could be that someone is sort of dominating the group and ends up doing all of the work and is leaving other people out or has decided that someone has not a lot to contribute. Or it can mean that some folks are just not interested in contributing. So one opportunity early in the class is to let students do some pro-con brainstorming about group work. And then from there to generate, maybe even in their actual small groups or maybe in a large group, a list of guidelines for how they might interact within small groups so that they can ensure that they get the positives of group work and so that they have a means of navigating through the potential problems that they might experience in group work. So that's one really powerful technique. Another is, we talked earlier about how tile classroom spaces make it really easy for instructors to move about a space.
Uh-huh.
So they can see whether groups seem to be productive and moving forward and everyone's contributing, or they can see whether people seem to be stuck someplace. And so as they observe students, they can check in with different small groups and see how those dynamics are evolving. And if something is happening where a student is repeatedly getting interrupted by another student, the instructor can actually intervene in a subtle way by saying, oh, well, you know, what this student said is actually a productive conversation for this group to have, and it can actually transfer some of their authority as the instructor to that student who maybe was being dismissed a little too quickly by some of the other students in the group. So sometimes students get the idea that active learning means instructors not doing anything, and I think most faculty find that actually they are way more engaged when they're facilitating in a space like this, and it's because they're keeping up with things like that.
Right, and that can be, I mean, from talking to, like, your colleague Cornelia Lang, who is on the podcast, right, you may have, you know, 80 students in the room, right? Some of these active learning classrooms are fairly large. And so, I mean, you can't talk to every student every hour, but the ability to circulate in a class session and check in with lots of different groups of students, it's really powerful.
It really is.
Yeah. So, What do you think instructors find challenging about teaching in these classrooms for the first time? What are there some misconceptions or some kind of mental models that they have to change up in order to use these classrooms well?
Faculty development that we do currently. So we no longer have, you know, not a brand new initiative with lots of resources to deploy in the same way that brand new initiatives sometimes have. So we no longer do the multi-day institutes. We aren't able to bring Professor Baker anymore. So we have two afternoon sessions. And the idea is to provide an opportunity for instructors to sort out a lot of those initial struggles in this space with other colleagues who are thinking through the same thing as opposed to during the first week of class.
Yeah.
And so the sessions are very much modeled to be active learning sessions. The facilitators do very little lecturing of any kind. In some ways, I guess you could say it's using air quotes or flipped. That anything that's just knowledge transfer that happens using our LMS prior to the session.
Okay.
And so
you're modeling some of the teaching practices
in
these training sessions.
Yeah,
okay.
And really we're just thinking about where is the tile classroom as a limited resource, where is it most useful to deploy certain kinds of teaching strategies?
Mm-hmm.
And when students are not in that space altogether, what kinds of teaching strategies make more sense for that kind of environment?
Yeah.
And so to sort of calibrate what you do when according to what resources you have on hand. And so in these afternoon sessions that we do, we call them tile essentials, the faculty get to experience being in the role of a student. We start out by putting them in the student's seats, and the facilitator will look around the room and say, tell me what you notice about this space. So within the first 4 seconds,
right. Yeah.
The participants are not only enjoying the role of students and recognizing that there are things like the fact that sometimes their back is to other students who might be speaking, or sometimes their back are, you know, to the facilitator themselves and what mm-hmm. that does in terms of audio, and mm-hmm. you know, we all read lips more than we think we do, and
yeah.
that says about accessibility, but also about what student expectations might be in that room. And mm-hmm. so we do a big brainstorm about what's different about this space or what's distinctive about this space and what implications might it have for teaching and learning. And so not only is that a nice activity to bring into the classroom from day one, so it's something that participants can just deploy right away.
Oh, sure, right, because their students yeah. may not have been in a classroom space like
exactly.
this before, so to actually use that activity with the students
exactly.
to clarify expectations and yeah. reduce confusion, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And then it also gets the whole group on the same page about what are some things we need to be mindful about. The rooms that have a lot of technology, there are a lot of screens, and potentially you might have multiple different things being projected at the same time, and a student might not know where to look.
Right, yeah.
Oh, and look at figure one, and then you move your slide forward. Well, if figure one was only appearing on one of those screens, a student might miss it. So
yeah.
you know, practices like saying, now if I can direct your attention to the large projector screen,
oh, sure.
let's look at figure one for a moment here.
Yeah, because Cornelia talked about how she might have a list of something on the document camera on one screen,
mm-hmm.
and then she would have some images or some data on the main screen, and then, of course, the students have their own screens.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that you might need a little navigational help.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to see all of those things simultaneously, but you have to make sure that if everyone's supposed to be directing their attention to one thing, that everyone is, in fact,
sure.
directing their attention to one thing. So, you know, that's how we spend the very first 5 minutes of the session, and really a lot of the sessions are on the same kind of model, which is that participants are experiencing the role of students.
Mm-hmm.
They have opportunities to sort of think through what was hard about being a student in this space, what was overwhelming about being a student in this space, how frequently might students need a moment just to pause and
mm-hmm.
reflect as individuals on what has been
oh,
happened.
Sure, yeah.
While this is a great space for collaboration, We know that for collaboration to be really productive, people also do need a minute to sort of figure out what the takeaway from all
yeah,
of this was,
right.
and potentially that might happen as individuals. So we actually have previous tile faculty come in and demonstrate what we call a module, and we use that term pretty loosely. So basically what it is a well-aligned activity. So something
mm-hmm.
where the tile professor has identified a specific measurable learning objective, has figured out what the assessment that is well aligned to that objective would be, and then has created an activity that will require students to be engaged mm-hmm. in sort of thinking through that process, maybe even identifying a process that hasn't been explained yet, so discovering for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
that process. And so the participants get to behave as students, get to see, you know, what it's like to be drawing on whiteboards or, you know, putting note cards in order and post-its everywhere,
yeah,
or whatever the
yeah.
activity might be. And to not only think about it from the role of students, but then afterward, to do some Q&A and debriefing with the veteran tile instructor
mm-hmm.
about, you know, what was your strategy in bringing all of this together? And why was it so important that the assessment be aligned with the activity
mm-hmm.
and that the activity be aligned with the learning objective? One of the things that can be sort of provocative in these spaces is to start designing around the space. And
yeah.
while that might be a lot of fun, if your course doesn't accomplish what you need it to accomplish
mm-hmm.
in terms of student learning, then that will be disappointing
mm-hmm.
to students.
Mm-hmm.
Or if students are, you know, if you have some really exciting learning objective and students are doing activities that, you know, are part of this really engaged and exciting learning objective, and then the final assessment is not well matched, they're going to perceive all of that active learning as busy work.
Yeah, yeah.
Because students tend to think of assessment as a way of figuring out what's important to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we spend a lot of time talking about alignment, a lot of time talking about the strategies and the strategic thinking behind course design that happens in these spaces, and also about what it feels like to be a student in these spaces.
Yeah. Now, the alignment's really key because you've got all of these affordances, you've got all these tools, and you could do an activity that's very engaging, but it might not be a great activity for the actual learning objective.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the disciplinary differences. Can you say more about that? Because I do think that a lot of the attention to active learning classrooms has come out of the STEM community, in part because it's such a different format, a different structure for classes that have traditionally been taught in large lecture halls. That's not always true in the humanities, for instance. They've often had kind of smaller, more discussion-oriented classrooms. Can you say what are some of those differences? Do you see differences in how the spaces are used across the disciplines?
But also one of the most exciting things about the faculty development is that we're bringing in groups of faculty from all over campus. So we'll have a nursing person sitting next to a philosopher. And one of the interesting things about teaching in these spaces is that when we think about the methods as much as the content, a lot of those things work really well regardless of the discipline. So,
okay.
You know, many different disciplines think about process. They might think about process at different ends or different kinds of process, but the strategies for getting students to contemplate process might look similar. And so one of the things that happens is that an activity gets done by either a panel instructor, or at one point we have opportunities for the participants in the faculty development to try out their own models
for
the very first time on their colleagues. And have sort of a fun interactive session where they brainstorm together. So a faculty member who does a demonstration might well find that someone from a radically different discipline has a strategy that will work well for their own content.
Sure.
And then we all benefit from getting out of our own silos from time to time and seeing what folks across campus are doing. And I think that's something that's really exciting about these active learning classrooms. When they were first built, the story is that there was a lot of concern that maybe faculty wouldn't be willing to leave their home buildings
to
teach in these spaces. And that has turned out not to be true at all. People are so excited by them that they're willing to, walk across campus.
Yeah.
And when they walk across campus, they'll often, arrive at the classroom space to see someone from a really different discipline, wiping down the whiteboards, having taught something radically different. But they'll say, oh, that's so interesting how you, use postcards to do that. So then those sort of organic conversations.
Sure. Well, and I think for those of us who work at teaching centers, we get to see this play out a lot. But I think faculty who are in their own little bubbles sometimes think that, so-and-so teaches English, not chemistry. What do we have in common? And often, there are important differences, certainly. But there's a lot in common, actually. Could you maybe give an example from the humanities, I think would be interesting, of a module or an activity that you've seen in these spaces?
So there's a professor of Spanish who did a really interesting activity that Sue modeled, where she had students do a jigsaw activity, so an activity where small groups each look at a different aspect of a question.
Okay.
And in this case, they were looking at an image that was depicting a Spanish term that could have multiple meanings.
Okay.
And so after they had done that in their own small groups and sort of figured out what they thought each picture was depicting, they then mixed up the groups. And then they had one member from each different picture interacting together. And because they were all coming with their own sort of expertise in some element of the question, that ensured that everybody was participating.
Oh, yeah.
And then they were able to have this really robust conversation about how language is context specific and how this particular term had all of these different meanings depending upon what assumptions you were making. And what does that mean for translation?
What does
that mean for the way we think about words as being precise?
Yeah, and so that's a fairly low-tech activity, right?
Absolutely.
But the room allows you to have one set of groups and very quickly move to a different set of groups. The group activity works better because students are actually looking at each other and engaging. And then you have that piece where the instructor can circulate and eavesdrop and help out here and there. Yeah, I love that. And I also, this idea, the kind of jigsaw idea that each student has their own experience or expertise that they're then bringing to a heterogeneous group, I think that works really well. Again, it depends on the learning objectives, but often you're wanting students to appreciate the complexity of something.
Exactly.
And so it's a great way to bring that complexity in very directly. And then, as you say, there's a reason to hear from every student in the group, because each student is the only one from that first set of group that has that perspective and that expertise.
Yeah.
So I love that. I love that.
So the veteran tile instructor demonstrated that activity with
okay.
a group of brand new tile instructors. And so in the degree, we talked about the importance of what the instructor is doing during that activity. And the really important piece is that in that first half, where students are all in homogeneous groups, they're all looking at the same image, that they come away with an appropriate understanding of
that
specific piece of the puzzle, so that what they brought to the heterogeneous groups was appropriate for the conversation before. So she was sort of watching to make sure that conversation was proceeding well.
Gotcha. So some kind of calibration and feedback in the first round of groups,
exactly.
so that they're really productive, so that enables the second round of groups to also be productive.
Yeah.
Right. These are subtle things, right?
Yeah.
And if you're just used to just kind of, lecturing half of your class period, you may not think about all of these dynamics.
And I think that's why the faculty development is so important, because until you've participated in something like that or watched someone else facilitate in something like that, it's really hard to miss, or it's really easy to miss those nuances. And, you'll probably figure them out the first time you do them, but if you participate in this kind of development prior to your first time in the classroom, you sort of know going in what are the potential pitfalls, what are the opportunities here to pull something extra out of an activity that you've developed. And so I think it's really exciting that faculty make the space to be thoughtful about their course designs and about the way they facilitate these activities prior to being in the classroom. And I think it sort of helps set them up for success. One of the cool things about the TAL program is we no longer have stipends. We don't actually do a lot of advertising beyond just making sure people are aware of the dates and times that we're hosting these sessions. And organically, we get a couple dozen people
great.
For every session. And I think it's because people recognize that it is calibrated to benefit them.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so our podcast is called Leading Lines, and we try to not predict the future, that seems a fool's errand, but shape the future. If you could imagine active learning classrooms 3 to 5 years out, what would you want them to look like? To what roles to play? What would be different?
I think that, I'm thinking about two different sets of colleagues I have in the teaching learning and technology, and that unit is really exciting because I have the opportunity to collaborate with folks who come at this from slightly different perspectives. So we have an assessment unit, so they're often involved in helping faculty to figure out how student learning outcomes are being affected by teaching in these spaces. And we also have a learning spaces unit, and they're always keeping an eye out for new technologies that might facilitate some of the things we want to do. So we're already experimenting with some things. So one example is a throwable microphone. I think maybe Cornelia
mentioned
that. And that's been interesting because we discovered that while that's a lot of fun in a tile classroom, in some ways it's even more fun in a large lecture space with fixed seating. A lot of instructors have that experience of having that center of the large lecture where you just can't get to students. Now you can throw a microphone.
Right. Yeah.
And our assessment unit is being really
It's powerful. Like a foam covered device,
it's
right?
Like
so it doesn't hurt. Okay.
Device, but our assessment unit is being really thoughtful about, how does that sort of thing affect student motivation? What if students are intimidated by this? How does it affect accessibility if we're throwing things at people? And so we're still sort of figuring out
Yeah.
What is the best way to deploy this, and when is it appropriate to deploy this? Because like any technology, we want to put the pedagogy first.
Sure, yeah.
So that's one example. Another one, the Learning Spaces technology team has recently implemented this sort of small iPad so that instead of being tied to the instructor podium, instructors can be navigating the classroom space, and if they see something interesting, they can go ahead and bring up
gotcha.
Students monitor to everyone's
so
screen.
From the tablet, they can kind of run all the screens in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it makes the lack of front of a room even more decentralized.
Oh, sure.
And that the
yeah.
front of the room, or wherever the instructor might be, could be anywhere in the classroom
yeah.
at any given moment.
Yeah.
So those are a couple of things that we're playing with now, and I'm so fortunate to have colleagues who are so enthusiastic about being part of the TAL program.
Yeah, and it gets back to what you said about the collaboration, right? At Iowa, it started in a very collaborative structure where you had people from different backgrounds and expertise, and that seems to be continuing. And I also really like the idea of taking some of the lessons we're learning about structure and engagement and affordances and technologies in the active learning space and trying to bring that into other teaching spaces, because most campuses can't just reinvent all their classrooms overnight. And so thinking about, well, what if we had a throwable mic in a stadium seating large lecture hall? How does that help us change things up? Or if we're going to do a renovation, we don't have a lot of money, how do we do an active learning classroom on the cheap and still get the best out of it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So our faculty are really partners in that because they say, you know, I teach this class in the classroom, but my other class is stuck in this large lecture hall, and so these are the things that I'm figuring out how to sort of
Those
are really fun conversations.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the things that we encounter a lot in our work at my teaching center is faculty tend to kind of teach as they were taught.
Yeah.
And so just getting them into a different classroom, getting them talking to colleagues, getting them to observe someone else teach, like all of a sudden their toolbox just gets more full, right? And it's great. It's great.
You know, teachers, they want their students to learn. So sometimes these conversations become about faculty buy-in, and I don't like that language.
Because
I think our faculty are already bought in. Hmm. They want to be successful in the classroom, and they want their students to be successful in the classroom. And so our role is just to sort of provide a space for them to have an opportunity to think through some of those things, and it's amazing what they come up with.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, yeah. Well, and teaching is such a creative act. I mean, I think sometimes we underestimate the role of that. So we have a final question we ask all of our guests. I think you knew this was coming. We talk a lot about digital educational technology on the podcast because that's really a space a lot of us are trying to figure out and map. But technology doesn't have to be digital. Do you have a favorite analog educational technology that you like to use in your own work or that you like when you're working with faculty that you like to recommend?
Honestly, the whiteboards.
Yeah.
I'm such a fangirl for a whiteboard. I think it's really exciting to be. I love whiteboards because they're erasable.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, a big part of learning and teaching is about iteration.
Yeah.
And so they really make that possible in a way that doesn't feel unfriendly. So I'm a big fan of post-its and the giant post-it notes when you don't have a whiteboard or a tool. But if you have to cross something out and you have to see it crossed out, and maybe that, you know,
right. Or you're less likely to put something down
exactly. Because
it doesn't feel finished.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same thing with typing notes in a Word document or something. You know, there's that cursor blinking at you demanding.
Right.
And the whiteboard is the space that's meant to be sort of creative, and you can throw things up there, and you can, you know, rearrange things,
and draw
lines between them, and use multiple colored markers, and I think it really facilitates creativity.
So I
do it when I'm thinking about my own to-do list. I do it when I'm working with a faculty member in course development, and I love seeing the way that people use it in the classroom.
Yeah, me too. That's great. Well, thank you, Anna. This has been really, really fascinating. Thanks for taking some time to talk with us about active learning classrooms.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Anna Bostwick Fleming, Associate Director at the Center for Teaching in the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the University of Iowa. I spoke with Anna at the 2018 POD Network Conference in Portland, Oregon. POD is a professional association for educational developers, the place where teaching center people like me connect and learn from each other. If you're in educational development, that is, if you work with faculty or grad students to help them teach well, you'll want to go to POD. I met Anna through Wayne Jacobson, Director of Assessment at Iowa, who's a POD colleague of mine from way back. And I've worked with Jean Florman, and Anna's boss at the Center for Teaching, who's one of the most thoughtful and hardworking educators I know. Before I get too sentimental about my pod colleagues, I should mention that if you're interested in the Tile Active Learning Classroom Initiative at the University of Iowa, check the show notes for links to further information. I'll throw in a link to my collection of classroom photos on Flickr, too. I get to visit lots of college and university campuses, and I like to take a few photos of innovative learning spaces when I travel. In the Flickr album, you'll find photos of Iowa's Tile classrooms and a number of other active learning classrooms. Also in the show notes, links to episodes 32 and 33 of Leading Lines, which also focus on active learning classrooms, and a brief lit review on active learning classrooms I posted on my blog last year. To find our show notes, as well as past episodes with full transcripts, visit our website, leadinglinespod.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook, too. Just search for Leading Lines Podcast. We would love to hear from you and connect with you that way. Leading Lines is produced by the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Libraries, and the Associate Provost for Education Development and Technologies, John Sloop. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.